Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Continuing the readings from these collected teachings of Lumpur Sumedho. This is volume 3, and these are talks from the book The Way It Is. And this is chapter 19, called Being Nobody, which we started yesterday. How many of you feel you have a mission in life to perform? Something you've got to do? Some kind of important task that's been assigned to you by God or fate or something? People frequently get caught up in that view of being somebody who has a mission. Who can just be with the way things are? So that it's just the body that grows up, breathes and is conscious, gets old and dies. We can practice, live within the moral precepts, do good, respond to the needs and experiences of life with mindfulness and wisdom. But there's nobody who has to do anything. There's nobody with a mission, nobody special. We're not making a person or a saint, an avatar or a tulku, a messiah or Maitreya. You may think, I'm just a nobody. But even being a nobody is being somebody in this life. You can be just as proud of being nobody as of being somebody, and just as deludedly attached to being nobody. But whatever you happen to believe, whether you're a nobody or a somebody, that you have a mission or you're a nuisance and a burden to the world, however you might view yourself, the knowing is there to see the cessation of such a view. So this is, hopefully people can get the theme of what Lumpur's talking about here. Even when you say, oh, I'm nobody, you can really be somebody saying that you're nobody. There's an old joke that goes, the two or three people praying in a temple together, and someone is saying, I'm unworthy, I'm unworthy, I'm unworthy. And one of the other people looks at them and says, look who thinks he's unworthy. There's a kind of being inflated about our spiritual unworthiness. So we can be attached to being no, as to being nobody as an identity as we can to being somebody, having an inflated view or having a sense of you've been put into this world for some special mission, some kind of special purpose. I remember years ago when I went along to the Buddhist Society Summer School, I think it was, with Lumpur Sumedho way back in the early 80s. It used to be organized quite close to here, actually, in the town of Hoddesdon, an old sort of large country house called Hailee. There'd be about 100, 120 people gathered together, people, regulars from the Buddhist Society, and they'd have a two-week-long summer school. And so people from the Theravada tradition or Zen tradition or Tibetan tradition would gather there for a couple of weeks of teachings and talks and classes and such like. And one of the people who attended this was very, say, ardent about the teaching on not self. So he would always refer to himself as it. And so he never said I or me or mine or used any of those ordinary personal pronouns. But he said, it's a bit hot. Can the window be opened? Or it would like a cup of tea. It's thirsty. And so even though there was this kind of, an admirable, say, respect for the teaching and a quality of commitment to that, can still be an I who's continuing to call itself it. There's still a self view forming. Or if in English language we write the word I, meaning the individual as a capital letter I, some people determinedly always write it with a lowercase I, and I find that when people do that, it jumps off the page. sort of a statement of atta, even though they're intending the opposite. You know, I'm not going to use a capital letter to refer to this condition, but because it's sort of outside the convention, then it's like, you know, look how unworthy I am. I don't use a capital letter for I. Yeah, again, I'm not trying to be overly critical. People have good intentions, and they have a lot of respect for the values of the teaching. But I think Lumpur puts it very, very well here. Just whether you consider yourself a saint or an avatar, or put onto this earth for some sort of special mission, or you've got this kind of amazing karmic potential that is laid out before you, and people have made prophecies about what you're going to do with your life, or if you're you have the sense of being a nobody, or that you're a nuisance, or that, you know, I'm a burden on the world. The world would be a better place if I wasn't occupying the space that I do. Those are equally open to self-view. In the Nidesa, which is one of the books of the Pali teachings, they have a matrix of the nine different kinds of conceit. And so that in the suttas, the Buddha talks about three kinds of conceit, of being superior, being average, and being inferior. But in the Nidesa, it sort of spells it out in even more detail. It says, if you are the best and you think you're the best, that's a conceit. If you are the best and you think that you're average, that's conceit. If you are the best and you think that you're the worst, that's conceit. If you're average and you think you're the best, that's conceit. If you're average and you think that you're average, that's conceit. If you're average and you think that you're the worst, that's conceit. If you're the worst and you think you're the best, that's conceit. If you're the worst and you think you're average, that's conceit. If you're the worst and you think you're the worst, that's still conceit. So these are called the nine types of conceit. So even when they're technically accurate, like, you know, if you think you're average and you are average, that's still, you know, I am. The manyati, that conceiving, is still very much a part of the picture. And as the Buddha said, conceiving is a disease, like a disease. It's like a cancerous tumor. It's stressful. It's burdensome. Any kind of I am that is attached to or believed in, that's intrinsically stressful, painful, burdensome. There's on this same theme about saying, you know, I'm unworthy, or, you know, I'm nobody, and so on and so forth, and it being unconsciously a way of being inflated. There's a little book we have some copies of here in the library and in the viharas. It's called Deceptive Defilements, and it was written by a Sri Lankan elder, a Mahathera, back in the early 60s, I think. And a regular supporter of this monastery did a translation of it into English, and I helped her to review the text and to get it into print. And the whole book is around defilements that disguise themselves as virtues. So that if you are a kind of major supporter of the temple, you know, you'd given lots of money, or you sponsored the construction of a stupa, or you've paid for the abbot's medical bills, or that you're the one who leads the chanting on the weekend. You know, when we used to have people coming to to join him in pujas here, so that that kind of say prominent layperson, that you're sort of an ardent devotee, and you're very, very sincere and very committed to the spiritual values of the Triple Gem, but you're really pleased that you're the sort of prominent lay disciple, and that you're very comfortable in that first position, and being the one at the front, and being known as being extremely generous or extremely devoted and dedicated. And so I felt it was a really, really skillful book. It's quite thorough. It goes through various different ways that defilements sort of disguise themselves as virtues. It can be around, not just around generosity or around say, being in a leading prominent layperson, but also around meditation skills, around being patient, yeah, around sort of renunciation, being someone who has fewness of needs. And so I felt it was a very useful handbook of these kind of insidious defilements, the way that we can look at a superficial view of particular qualities and think, well, this is a demonstration of being generous or being a renunciate or being patient or being kind or and so on and so forth. But it's helping us to look below the surface and see, well, yes, that's what's there at the kind of apparent level, but what's the attitude behind it? You know, what is the mind building out of that and helping to illuminate those subtle qualities of conceit, you know, like, you know, being a renunciant, you can, you know, be really, really strict and rigorous about the things that you don't use or your fewness of needs or being able to endure a lot of discomfort. But you can be really proud of your prowess as a renunciate. You can be really pleased to be the champion ascetic. And it can be really challenging, and I speak from personal experience, if you are very much identified with being an ascetic. Then I remember, I think a few weeks ago, I mentioned when Lumpur Sumedho, back in the 80s here, he handed me a Danish pastry, and I immediately passed it on to the next monk. He said, "No, it's for you." And I had this quick, but you know, I'm the ascetic. I don't eat sweet, nice things like this, you know. And he kind of gave me that look, like, "It's for you, Venerable." Okay, it was one of those transmissions outside the scriptural teachings. So I ate the Danish pastry. Yeah. But and so, yeah, I was kind of proud of being an ascetic monk, and so that little book, I forget the name. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the author, but the book's called Deceptive Defilements. It's got a brown cover. And so I do recommend people taking a look at that, just in case you want to check your own check your own profile. But it's very very skillfully written and very very easy to read. And also, he's not kind of you know, hypercritical or sort of scolding in his way, but the attitude with which he writes is, you know, look at this. This is important to know. This is interesting to see how we can get ourselves tangled up in these mind states without being aware of it. So to continue, so however you might view yourself, the knowing is there to see the cessation of such a view. Views arise and cease. The view, "I'm somebody, an important person who has a mission in life," arises and ceases in the mind. Notice the ending of the view of being somebody important, or being nobody, or whatever. It all ceases. Everything that arises ceases. So there's a non-grasping of the view of being somebody with a mission, or of being nobody. There's the end of that whole mass of suffering, of having to develop something, become somebody, change something, set everything right, get rid of all your defilements, or save the world. Even the best ideals, the best thoughts, can be seen as dhammas that arise and cease in the mind. You might think that this is a barren philosophy of life, because there seems to be a lot more heart and feeling in being somebody who's going to save all sentient beings. People with self-sacrifice, who have missions, help others, and have something important to do, are an inspiration. But when you notice that as dhamma, you're looking at the limitations of inspirations and their cessation. Then there is the dhamma of those aspirations and actions, rather than somebody who has to become something or do something. The whole illusion is relinquished. And what remains is purity of mind. Then the response to experience comes from wisdom and purity, rather than from a personal conviction of a mission, with its sense of self and other, and all the complications that come from that whole pattern of delusion. Can you trust that? Can you trust in letting everything go and cease, not being anybody and not having any mission, not having to become anything? Can you really trust in that? Or do you find it frightening, barren, or depressing? Maybe you really want inspiration. Tell me everything's all right. Tell me you really love me. What I'm doing is right, and Buddhism is not just a selfish religion where you get enlightened for your own sake. Tell me that Buddhism is here to save all sentient beings. Is that what you're going to do, Venerable Sumedho? Are you really Mahayana or Hinayana? What I'm pointing to is what inspiration is as an experience. Idealism, not trying to dismiss it or judge it in any way, but to reflect on it, to know what it is in the mind, and how easily we can be deluded by our own ideas and high-minded views, and to see how insensitive, cruel, and unkind we can be through the attachment that we have to views about being kind and sensitive. This is a real investigation into Dhamma. Oh, this, these are very so helpful, insightful teachings, and that I think for all of us, the kind of people who like to live in Buddhist monasteries, practice meditation, and who honor and revere the qualities of wholesomeness and goodness, that it's natural for us to have these kind of aspirations, or to be inspired by people who do a lot of good things in the world, and a sense of wanting to fulfill our potential as a human being and to do the best we can with this life. But I think what Lumpur is pointing to here is extremely skillful, because we can, say, attach to those manifestations of generosity or unselfishness or compassion, and that and then become reliant upon that inspiration or being inspired. And as he would often say, doesn't say it in this talk, but he would often say, you can't inhale permanently. You can't have a permanent inhalation. Inspiration, as I was saying yesterday, it literally means to breathe in, to inspire, to breathe in. So you can't have a permanent inhalation. You can't be inspired all the time. it's physically impossible. And so that when we admire so great spiritual figures or people who have had a big impact in the world, and we can say, yeah, that's really it. Even though those might be very noble and helpful actions and attitudes, we can be unconsciously sort of taking refuge just in the inspiration, in that feeling of being inspired, and at calling that as an intrinsic and absolute good, those wholesome actions. And that it's not that they're unwholesome, but we're attaching to the perception of that and the superficial view of it. And so what Lumpur is pointing to here is a whole sort of other layer of wisdom, understanding, and seeing that the goodness arises and ceases, badness arises and ceases. That whether you're somebody or you're a nobody, those all arise and cease. I'm somebody, I'm important. I'm a person who has a mission in life. That arises and ceases in the mind. I'm being a nobody. I'm unimportant. That arises and ceases in the mind. So it's taking the whole appreciation of reality, of our experience of this human realm, to a whole sort of deeper and more complete level, I would say. So that, and as he points out, most importantly, then the response to experience comes from wisdom and purity rather than from a personal conviction of a mission. So you're not coming from like, I want to be like Mother Teresa, or I want to be like St. Francis of Assisi, or I want to be like the Dalai Lama, or I want to be like that. Sort of being inspired by an impactful and impressive figure, and feeling that you want to be that way, you should be that way, and if you're not that way, then you're missing out, or you're not doing the best you can. That, in a sense, living up to an ideal, the mind creates a projection, an image, an idea of a good person or a fulfilled person, and then you're trying to get born into that mental creation. And what Lumpur is pointing to here is that when there's that appreciation on the profound level of Dhamma, and there's a recognition that inspiration is followed by expiration or desperation, inhalation is followed by exhalation, seeing the whole picture, then the response to experience comes from wisdom and purity rather than from personal conviction of omission. So rather than coming from self-view and I should, I must, I want to, then there's a much more complete and profound attunement to Dhamma. You're coming from, as he says, you're coming from wisdom and purity. So the heart's attunement to the field of experience, to reality, moment by moment. And then from that attunement, if something can be done and action can be taken, then you do it. If nothing can be done or there's nothing to say or do, then you can leave it alone. And you're not defining your worth or your effectiveness by just the things that you do. If there's nothing to be done, then the skillful thing to do is to leave things alone, rather than getting busy trying to do some kind of wholesome or inspiring action. That we are sort of genuinely attuned to the reality of the present, rather than coming from a view based on conception, based on I and me and mine, trying to be something or fulfill some idea of a destiny or a mission. And so that we, in a mysterious way, we actually become more effective in what we do when we come from that place of wisdom and attunement than when we come from a sense of obligation or just trying to act out a particular ideal or a model that we've picked up along the way or we're inspired by. So any thoughts, questions, reflections? Ajahn Kuchana, please, you can use the microphone.
Yeah, so listening to what you're saying and reflecting on the biographies of many spiritual teachers and practitioners who seem to have made the practice really work for them, it seems very common that they start with a attitude of becoming. You're describing it yourself. There's the Lumpur Lee, I guess, when he was a novice, made the vow, I'll do twice as much sitting and walking meditation as that other novice in the kuti next door. Total becoming. But he learned he could do more sitting and walking than he imagined. And so I'm wondering, for myself, I'd be a little bit cautious about saying that has no, because the value of that at the beginning can be very helpful. I don't know if maybe there's other people who, for whom this teaching works at the beginning, and then they just sort of grow into that. I'm not sure. I'm curious what you, but certainly the people I can think of, Lumpur Sumedho, Lumpur Suchito, they both of them overshot. Went into the becoming mode. And I don't know, maybe there's other teachers who have, who have sort of followed another path where they started out with the non-becoming mode. But I'm just curious what if you have any perspectives on that.
Good question. I think we all start from where we are. I think in a way it's a bit of a self-selecting group. The kind of people that come into Buddhist monasteries or sign up for meditation retreats where you're going to be, start just on a 10-day retreat, to determine to not speak to anybody, to follow a routine that's imposed from outside, hand over your cell phone, and to sit and walk, all day long for 10 days. That demonstrates a certain amount of ardor, readiness to engage and do something with your mind. So it's, in a way, the kind of people that come to monasteries or sign up for retreats, it is a self-selecting group. So I think in that respect, it's common to launch into meditation practice and spiritual practice with a lot of that becoming energy, you know, with bhavatanna, vibhavatanna. And I found Lumpur Sumedho's teachings on that incredibly helpful, because when he first started speaking in those terms, right in the early days, you could tell for many of us, it's like, oh my goodness, oh right, oh, didn't even know that existed. Oh right, you can read hear Dhamma talks, or you can read the instructions in the suttas or in Dhamma books that you read, and it seems to be, you know, yes, get concentrated, get insight, get rid of your defilements. And that getting this and getting rid of that seems to be following the instructions. And so I think for most people, one tends to start out from that and just not even knowing that bhavatanna and vibhavatanna exist. And when I first heard Lumpur Sumedho talking about that, when I came to England in late 79, you know, I'd been in robes for nearly a couple of years by that time. So it was complete news to me. And then hearing him talking about it, it's like, what's he talking about? What does that mean? Becoming what? And desire to get rid of, but we are supposed to get rid of our defilements. You know, it says so. I've heard it dozens of times. I've heard that. So just getting a feeling for what that is and how that works, that took quite a long time just to get a sense of that. The way that we work with that, you know, then it depends a bit on the skill of the teacher or the skill of the student, because you can say, once you've got a sense for how that becoming energy works and all the desire to get rid of, but then even having an understanding of how that works, you can still mishandle it. So that you can see, oh, I'm totally wrapped up in becoming, therefore I should just eat as much as I want, sleep as much as I want, you know, ignore the routine of the monastery, and that's how I transcend becoming. Like, and then you find yourself getting into arguments with everyone that you live with, who are saying, you never get up in the morning, or why didn't you do your chore, and you know, and you're being really disrespectful in terms of the Vinaya, you know, you can't operate that way, and so. That like a wrong understanding of letting go can be part of it. I feel it takes both skill on the part of the teacher and skill on the part of the student, the kind of readiness to see how the practice is working and to adjust the way that you operate. Some people are already incredibly serious, and that even when they think about sort of relaxing and letting go, they're still sort of really wound incredibly tight. And so that their version of letting go, they need to relax a whole lot more, because they're really kind of hyper tense and serious and stressing themselves. And other people who say, yeah, I really need to kind of, you know, be more rigorous, but their version of being rigorous is still pretty loose. So part of it is getting to know your own character, listening to the advice of your teachers, your mentors, your peers, your kind of Kalyanamita, and to be ready to get the feedback from the people around you, because you know, particularly with this kind of area, delusion is a major player, moha, and so when we're dealing with greed and hatred, dosa and loba, they're very easy to recognize. You know, aversion, hatred, and greed, passion. They've got clear edges. They're quite tangible. But delusion and an attitude, opinion, habit, it can be very intangible, invisible. You can't. The very means whereby you would recognize a delusion is clouded, because the mind is deluded. So, in working with delusion, moha, then one of the major factors is the feedback you get from others, particularly your trusted teachers, your Kalyanamita, people who are close to you, who know you. And so then that's the best way of getting a perspective on your own opinions, your attachments, the way that you're picking things up, because you can't really trust your own judgment, you know, that because of the level of moha, delusion. So it's much trickier. What they call the mohacharit, the deluded type of personality, in the main part is much harder to work with than the dosacharit, the aversion type, or the lobacharit, the greed type. So, and it's one of the great blessings of community life, you know, living with other people. If you're just by yourself and you haven't got any peers around you, then your delusions and your preferences and your fears can be, you know, very happily unchallenged for years and years and years. But when you live close to other people, and different personalities, different perspectives, different experience, then they can give you, you know, really helpful feedback that you just wouldn't have otherwise. You wouldn't be able to get that kind of perspective on your own attitudes, your own functioning. You wouldn't be able to see where the mind is attached or frightened or aversive. Any other questions? Okay, to continue. I remember that in my own experience, I always had the view that I was somebody special in some way. I used to think, well, I must be a special person. Way back when I was a child, I was fascinated by Asia, and as soon as I could, I studied Chinese at university. So surely, I must have been a reincarnation of somebody who was connected to the Orient. But consider this as a reflection. No matter how many signs of being special, or previous lives you can remember, or voices from God, or messages from the cosmos, whatever, I'm not denying those things, or saying that they aren't real, but they are impermanent. They are anicca, dukkha, anatta. We're reflecting on them as they really are. What arises ceases. A message from God is something that comes and ceases in your mind. God isn't always talking to you continuously, unless you want to consider the sound of silence, the voice of God, but then it doesn't really say anything. We can call it anything. We can call it the voice of God, or the divine, or the ringing of the cosmos, or blood in our eardrums. But whatever it is, it can be used for mindfulness and reflection. That's what I'm pointing to. How to use these things without making them into something. Then the missions we have are responses, but not to experiences that we have in our lives. They're not personal anymore. It's no longer me, Sumedho Bhikkhu, with a mission, as if I'm specially chosen from above, more so than any of you. It's not that anymore. That whole manner of thinking and perceiving is relinquished. And whether or not I do save the world and thousands of beings, or help the poor in the slums of Calcutta, or help to cure all lepers and do all kinds of good works, that would be done not from the delusion of being a person, but as a natural response from wisdom. So this is an interesting comments from Lumpo Sumedho, and he's mentioned this many times. He had a fascination with China. He was born in 1934, and when he was 13 or 14 years old, he was already looking forward. There was a university in Shanghai called St. John's University, and they had a program in America. You could go and study at St. John's University in Shanghai. And as a teenager, Lumpo Sumedho was really excited about that and was all kind of lined up to, when he was 18, he'd be able to go off to China and study in Shanghai. And then when the Communist Revolution took place in China, and the government fell in 1949, and the Communist government took over, and they closed that that program with the United States, he was about 14 at that point. He said he was really brokenhearted. It's like, oh no, I can't go to China. This is terrible. But as it happened, he grew up in Seattle. And the University of Washington in Seattle had a Chinese language program. So he did learn Chinese, but in Seattle rather than in Shanghai. but he had a fascination and a connection with that kind of aspect of Asia from early childhood. And when he went to visit the city of 10,000 Buddhas, and he met Master Xuanhua back in the early 80s. I went along a few times to Lumpur to meet Master Hua and to visit City of 10,000 Buddhas. We ran a couple of meditation retreats there. Lumpur Sumedho led one of them. I think that was 1991. And then Master Hua casually mentioned, me and Sumedho, we go way back. Yeah, we were cultivators together before, which you could see, you know, Lumpur Sumedho was kind of surprised that Master Hua would say that in a public forum, but he sort of took that in. But then that's the kind of challenge if you do get those kind of comments made by people who are in a position of authority or who speak from their own experience or from a place of truthfulness and honesty. Then what does the mind do with that? You have some kind of reading of or statement about a past life you might have had, or someone makes a prophecy about what you're going to become in the future. You go and see an astrologer or a palmist or some kind of psychic person who says, oh, yes, you're going to be a great teacher. You'll have many disciples and so on and so forth. And the challenge is that that might be said, and also in Dhamma talks, Lumpur Sumedho mentioned that one time a psychic in Thailand told him, he said, "You were Lumpur Cha's grandmother in a recent previous lifetime." And not in this talk, but in another Dhamma talk, he said, "Yeah, I quite like that." So, in terms of being told something, being Lumpur Cha's granny, I thought, I could relate to that. It's kind of a warm glow in the heart, the idea of being Ajahn Chah's grandmother. But he said, but then what do you do with it? What's the challenge is to say, okay, well, that's a statement that somebody has made. Do I make a thing out of it? Do I see myself as special? But even these kind of messages, they're anicca, dukkha, anatta. And the challenge is that, as well, maybe Lumpur was with Master Hua in a previous lifetime in China, or maybe he was Lumpur Cha's grandmother. And maybe those are completely accurate. But here and now, the most helpful thing is to recognize that even accurate statements of that nature are anicca, dukkha, anatta. And if we then say, forget that and grasp hold of it and say, I'm a special person, or I've got this great destiny, or I was somebody really important in a previous lifetime. Right there, the mind is creating the sort of seeds of self-view and conceit, that manyati, that eye-making and mind-making. And so even something of that nature, which has many wholesome resonances to it, then becomes a source of dukkha. It becomes an I am this, or I am special, or I've got a mission or a purpose or a great karmic destiny. And then something that has a wholesome origins or wholesome qualities then gets distorted, gets twisted. And again, that's one of the challenges of delusion, is being able to recognize, that here you have some sort of spiritual authority telling you there's something unique or important or special about you. So this also is anicca, dukkha, anatta, and to let go of that, not to build anything out of it. And similarly, the way of, as he's talking here, the way of relating to the nada sound, and you can speak, you can think of it as the song of the universe, or the voice of the divine, or ringing in your ears, the blood in your eardrums. We don't have to make a big thing of it, but we know we can use the presence of that sound as a reminder. It can be something that is a skillful means that brings a lot of blessings with it. Any questions, thoughts, reflections? Oh, okay. This I trust. This is what Saddha is. It's faith in the Buddha's word. Saddha is a real trust and confidence in Dhamma, in just waiting, being nobody, not becoming anything, but being able just to wait and respond. If there's nothing much to respond to, it's just waiting. Coffee cup in hand, watching the rain, the sunset, getting old, witnessing the aging process, the comings and goings in the monastery, the ordinations and the disrobings, the inspirations and the depressions, the highs and the lows, inside the mind, outside in the world, and there is the response. Because when we have vigor, intelligence and talent, life always comes and asks us to respond to it in some skillful and compassionate way, which we're very willing and able to do. We like to help people. I wouldn't mind going to a Buddhist leper colony. I'd be glad to. Or working in the shanty towns of Calcutta or wherever. I'd have no objections. Those kind of things are rather appealing to my sense of nobility. But it's not a mission. It's not me having to do anything. It's trusting in the Dhamma. Then the response to life is clear and of benefit, because it's not coming from me as a person and the delusions of ignorance, conditioning mental formations. We observe the restlessness, the compulsiveness, the obsessiveness of the mind, and let it cease. We let it go, and it ceases. So this is a that basic principle of watching a person coming into being, that the when the mind is really awake, when there is vijja, there's that awakened awareness, then there's that responsivity, the heart is attuned to the way things are, the field of experience in this moment. And there's, as I said, if there's something to do, then we do it. If there's nothing to do, then we leave things alone. But there, and so that we're not coming from being a person. But as soon as there's ignorance, as soon as the mind is not seeing clearly, then avijja paccaya sankhara, the ignorance conditions formations, the mind creates the world of things, subject and object, me here, the world there, and then gets drawn into that that dynamic, and we create a person who's moving around in the world and is attached to the cycles of birth and death, gaining and losing, success and failure, and so on. And so that it's a radical quality of attunement that we are taking as our refuge. When we talk about taking refuge in Dhamma, trusting in the Dhamma, it's like that embodying of Dhamma and really trusting that, and not coming from, we have to get to know those habits of I should, I must, I used to, I want to. And there's, say, the conditioning of the mind around personhood and our life story and the things that we do and our particular, say, responsibilities or our particular talents and personality and so on. But recognizing that is the I should, I must, I used to, I want to, and seeing that in perspective, just not buying into that, not being born into that. And then life is lived from a place of responsivity and attunement. And life is very, very simple. You can live day by day, moment by moment. You don't have to do a lot of planning, or you don't have to do a lot of recollecting, you know, of regretting the past or longing for the past and being nostalgic, or planning the future or hoping for the future or fearing the future. The heart is very much attuned to the reality of the present, and there's great peacefulness, a great ease, a great simplicity there. So that's the end of the Dhamma talk. Any questions, thoughts, reflections? Yes, Maureen.
I don't know actually if you're the right person to ask this question, but when I reflect on, you know, as a lay person, I mean, obviously, I don't know who his audience was. Well, no, his audience was monastics there. I guess the intentions that one would set as a monk or nun would be a lot different than, you know, for me as a lay person, the balance of trying to create intentions that are in line with Dhamma, but that also, you know, pay my mortgage and...
The what?
Pay my mortgage.
Oh, yes.
Those words don't even mean anything to you.
The mortgage, yes.
You know, that's, for me, that's just, it's almost a daily, those conceptual thoughts are a daily occurrence about how to do that and balance that with my spiritual aspirations and my Dhamma intentions. And I feel, you know, kind of torn apart by it. You know, actually, the older I get, it's getting worse. The feeling of, you know, one is pulling me in one direction and the other is pulling me in the other direction, and they're becoming less and less compatible intentions. Like I said, I don't know if this is something you can speak to or it's just a reflection, but if you have some words of wisdom on this, it would be much appreciated.
Yes. Well, the monastic life is a sort of deliberate simplicity, but you can still make it very complicated. You can get very wrapped up in the politics of monastery life, and the and so, you know, it's, we're sort of professional renunciates, and have, you know, we're celibate. We have very, you know, few possessions, but still, it's very possible to get wrapped up in all sorts of, you know, responsibilities that we have, or the way that we judge people. We admire this person, we criticize that person. We can obsess on how it should be done this way, it shouldn't be done that way. And so even though our life is sort of formally a renunciate life and aims towards simplicity, it still depends on your attitude moment by moment. And so I'm not putting down monastic life or criticizing Amaravati at all, but just saying, even when your life is deliberately structured to be as simple as possible, you can still make it very complicated because of attitude. And so that, I gave up being a layperson in 1978, so I can't really. I was 21 when I left lay life. So I can't really talk. I've never tried to be a lay Buddhist. You know, I encountered Buddhism when I was already in the monastery. So I never tried to be a lay Buddhist. So I can't really, I definitely can't speak from experience of trying to have a mortgage and a job and so on. But what I would say, and also speaking with many, many people over the years, lay people visiting the monasteries or coming on retreats and attending teachings or whatnot, simplicity is the most important thing. And simplicity isn't just a matter of how many hours in a day you have to spend in the workplace, but it revolves a lot around attitude. And that, and so that in terms of working life or paying your mortgage, then whatever conduces towards simplicity, and particularly in terms of your attitude, how you hold the place where you live, the work that you do, the relationships that you have, the way you connect with other people, or the way you you use your time, the way that you are sort of inclined towards solitude and so on and so forth, that there's a lot that we can do to make our life very supportive of Dhamma practice, even while you have to make a living and pay the mortgage and so on and so forth. So that if you look at your life and look at your attitudes and reflect on that as closely as possible, then it can become apparent of, okay, this is where I make things really complicated. this is where I really get lost. I get really wrapped up in this. That area, that's no problem. That's kind of easy. That's straightforward. This is where I really get entangled and I create a lot of stress and agitation and anxiety and busyness. Okay, that's the area I have to learn about. That's where I'm creating complication. Either in taking on too many responsibilities or feeling that you've got to be in endless communication with everybody or being over-obsessed about some particular aspect of the work that you're doing. So it's going to vary from person to person. It's going to be unique. But that sense of looking at where we get lost and particularly where we create a lot of conceptual proliferation, complication, and to see, okay, how can that be changed? How can that be ameliorated? How can I change the attitude towards that area of this life so that it inclines towards more simplicity, more clarity, more a sense of uncomplicatedness? And again, it can be. It's going to vary enormously for everybody. So you really have to get to know your own character, because it might be that you don't really worry about money at all. That's a sort of that looks after itself. But you're always criticizing other people. You're always complaining. I mean, I'm not reading your mind or saying, but that can be. No, I mean, it could be that you never complain about anybody, but you're obsessed about how much money is coming in and how much is going out. And so that side is really not a problem. I'm able to sort of leave people alone. If they're not around, I don't think about them. Fine. But this area, I'm just getting really wrapped up and stressed. Okay, that's the area I need to look at. So that getting to know your own personality, atanyuta, it's got that sense of becoming familiar with your own character and seeing where you get entangled, and then that's where we need to put the attention. And then a very good set of standards, what's called the advice to Gotami, when Mahaprajapati Gotami was a newly ordained nun. And she went to the Buddha asking for advice about how can I tell whether something's in accord with Dhamma or not in accord with Dhamma. Then he gave her this set of points, eight points to reflect upon. And they're saying if it leads to complication, then it's not in accordance with Dhamma. If it leads to simplicity, then it is. If it leads to fewness of needs, then it's in accordance with Dhamma. If it leads to a neediness, then it's not. So if you look that up, then that works as much for lay life as it does for monastic life. So the advice to Gotami, I think it's in the Book of the Eights in the Anguttara, but I couldn't name the exact sutta number off the top of my head. But it's totally pertinent advice. But it also, it depends on a sense of objectivity. Okay, do I do that? Is that a habit? Is that not? What's the pattern of things in my life? And then you find that so much of the suffering that we experience and difficulty and the challenges are based on attitude. And I wouldn't say everything depends on attitude, but a lot. A lot does. And we don't realize how much we are capable of changing the attitude that we have. It tends to be very, very fixed. And we see things, a certain area of our life in a certain way, and then it's got to be that way. It's always been that way. And I would say it doesn't. It's just a habit. And that a huge amount of suffering, particularly in the sort of the comfortable, reasonably stable countries in the West and around the world, that a huge amount of suffering, the majority of suffering, I would say, depends upon the attitude that we have. And so even when you've got like a physically simple life. I mean, you were showing me the pictures of the place where you live, and you're living there by yourself. You know, it's got a beautiful view over the Carmel Valley and so on. But still, even in living by yourself with a beautiful view, you can still suffer, I would predict. Even that, so on a practical level, it can be very simple, but what the mind does with it can make it very stressful or burdensome and complicated. So if we really want peacefulness, if we really want things to, in a sense, come together, then it's not just how we arrange our day. I would say it's mostly to do with how we arrange the attitude. That's the key. And that where we can see how we're making it difficult for ourselves, how we're burning a lot of energy in certain areas, and just to be able to recognize, I don't need to do that. Why do I do that to myself? Why do I make that important? Oh, and then it takes work to let go of the entrenched attitudes, but it's work that's really worthwhile. Okay. So I think we can end things there for today.